You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2024 Vuelta a España from Lisboa to Madrid.
Young Richard Abraham replacing Cartel Reyes, second week of the Vuelta a España. Buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes, Daniel.
Daniel, I'm not sure I'm comfortable. Daniel. Danny. Danny, usually when I have to make restaurant reservations over the phone, it's Danny. I don't know why. It makes me sound like a fancy pants Spanish, overpriced Spanish footballer, which, you know.
Yeah, Danny. I was Cofidis was signed.
Yeah.
On a bit of a whim for a Vuelta breakaway or two.
Yeah, Danny. To be honest, I wouldn't put it past Cofidis to sign me anyway, Richard. Some of their recruitment. Anyway, I am in Bayona, which is where, nothing to do with the French city of Bayonne, which is also called Bayona in Spanish, but I'm in a lovely little square, as you can probably hear. The architecture has changed, people's accents have changed, the light quality has changed, Richard. The way, just the, you know, the way the air feels on your skin has changed, certainly, since we made our long, very long, excessively long voyage, I would call it a voyage, from Andalucía yesterday. Of course, it was the rest day. I drove up from Linares in Andalucía. And last night, we were staying in Portugal, which caused all sorts of confusion, I have to tell you, Richard, because I couldn't get my pea brain around this one-hour time difference. We were actually staying on the Minho River, literally on it. You could throw a stone into the Minho River from Valencia. On the other side of the Minho River is Spain, and the start was in Spain this morning. So I was completely confused, disoriented, discombobulated by this, so much so that I couldn't even set an alarm to get up last night. I set a timer instead. I knew that I had to be up in 8 hours, but I didn't trust my phone not to change time zones overnight, if you know what I mean. Because it was on a Portuguese network and it was on Portuguese time, but I thought it might change to a Spanish time, so I thought this is a recipe for disaster. So I just set a timer.
Do I need to fly out, Daniel? Like, get a last-minute flight and make sure you make it.
If you could bring me a rooster, that would have come in handy last night.
I'll make some inquiries.
Yes. Anyway, Richard, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you, Daniel. Yeah, I'm also in a blue-sky, temperate environment. The wind is gentle and soft on the skin, but I'm not in Spain. I'm at home. I'm at home in Oxford, following the Vuelta remotely. You've probably used up all your carbon credits, carbon footprint already, the Vuelta, so... You know, I'm doing the honourable thing and staying put.
Easy. Very unfortunate. And this is something that various people complained about today, of course, the transfer. We've complained about it for three or four years in a row now, these ridiculous long transfers we have to make. I was speaking to Luis Angel Mate, the Lynx, this morning, and he was bemoaning these long transfers that the Vuelta makes every year, particularly from the point of view of climate change. And, of course, climate change, or very hot weather, was certainly a big topic of conversation last week. Things have got significantly cooler as we have moved north, which I think is good news for everyone, certainly good news for the riders. And Richard, I propose, before I take you back chronologically to this morning, take you back in spirit to Ponte Arias this morning, I propose we go back in time even further, because on today's route, and in fact it was the final climb on today's route, we had a climb called the Alto de Mugas. And this has become enshrined in Vuelta folklore, in the Vuelta's recent history. Why? Because it was the scene of a famous incident involving the rider formerly known as Superman López, Miguel Ángel López. 2 days from the end of the 2021 Vuelta a España, was on course to finish on the podium. What happened? He got dropped on the Alto de Mugas, 3 climbs from the end of the stage, and he threw the most almighty hissy fit, and minutes thereafter he abandoned the race and abandoned Movistar, and things have not gone well for Miguel Ángel López since. However, as I say, this incident is one of these infamous occasions that we sort of talk about with a kind of guilty nostalgia. And, well, I propose we do that now. This morning in Ponte Arias, I spoke to a couple of people who were involved, very much involved that day. And Jack Haig was one of them. He got third place in that Vuelta because Miguel Ángel López pulled out. Carlos Verona, alas, wasn't involved, but should have been, because he was on the same Movistar team as Miguel Ángel López. He'd crashed out of the Vuelta a España. Here's a little vignette reminding us of that fateful day.
After a flurry of attacks, Bernal and Lopez were both distanced. Roglic and Co quickly putting time into the Lopez group, with Superman set to lose his place on the podium.
Ha grabado con su móvil toda esta imagen que hemos comentado o que él nos comentaba antes y que no hemos podido ver.
As probably was Movistar's plan, went with that move. The difference being that that move didn't sit up. They pressed on.
It's really hard to tell because you don't know the state of fatigue at the time. And although it looks as if it looks almost a soft move.
Because it wasn't on a steep part of a climb, was it?
No, it wasn't. But soft move or not, as soon as the gap's there, it's very hard to close it.
I was in the hospital after a crash, so I could watch it from television. The memories are not the best. I remember some frustration watching the stage through the television. But yeah, this is part of the story of cycling. I don't know. I think he had a strong character. He was somebody very impulsive, you know. And I think he didn't think about it in the moment, so...
Sure, if we got told on the radio, to be honest, I think we only found out at the finish line. I think we got told that he'd been obviously distanced and that I was moving into the podium spot, but it wasn't until we got to the finish line where I actually found out that he'd pulled out, and I saw a little bit of all the controversy on social media about what had happened and him getting in the car. So during the stage, the director didn't actually tell us. I think I've had moments where I maybe wished I'd gotten off the bike just because of how hard it was, but I'd never properly considered it. Maybe I wished for a flat tire in a certain moment as well, just to have a bit of rest, but to actually get off the bike and get in the car, especially when you're in a moment like Miguel Ángel López was, where he was on the podium there, it was quite an important thing for Movistar. I'd never considered it. To be honest, it's I think of Gino Mehta, to be honest. He was really influential for me that whole Vuelta a España, and then especially this day, he sacrificed a lot for me to try and take as much time as possible to move up into that third place on general classification. So yeah, I have a lot of fond memories from that year, to be honest. Not just the Vuelta, that year with Gino, and yeah, I watched back and I saw some highlights from the stage from 21, and yeah, made me think of him.
It's unbelievable. Like, obviously we had a plan for today. That was not our plan, but it worked well, I'd say. Yeah, we put Jack on the podium as we wanted. I think we still have the lead in the team classification. Now it's official that I'm in white. I'd say a pretty successful day. I'm still a domestic, just for Jack. Sadly, we lost Landa. It was really not an easy race for him, but I think with the way we raced, we did him proud, and yeah, I'm looking forward to race again with Jack. Maybe as a domestique, maybe as a co-leader, we will see.
Well, Richard, I thought it was appropriate to remember Miguel Ángel López, but also appropriate and poignant as well, certainly from our point of view, to remember Gino Mehta, who of course tragically passed away last year in the Tour de Suisse. And also our great, late great friend, Richard Moore, who was with me in 2021 at the Vuelta a España. He experienced that crazy day with me, and it will have stirred up some memories for a few people at the Vuelta a España today. I wanted to get to Pachi Vila, the Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe direct sportif, after the finish to ask him what he felt today driving over that climb, because of course he was in the Movistar car, and he was one of the individuals trying to tempt Miguel Angel Lopez back onto his bike and failing.
Did you manage to find Pachi?
Did not manage to find Pachi. I'm struggling to catch up with Pachi.
I went back and had to kind of refresh my memory about this story, but there was a sort of blind spot where for a few hours the team didn't really know where Miguel Angel Lopez had gone, as far as I could tell.
Yes, there was. And then he did a call to Colombian radio stations and television where he sort of apologised, and it looked as though things were going to be, well, there was going to be a reconciliation of sorts. But then within hours, these rumours surfaced that actually he had wanted to go back to Astana all along, and that this was maybe a way for him to get out of his contract. And he duly did get out of his contract.
Just
and he
completely down tools.
Completely down tools. But what a day. What a day, Richard. Were we going to see anything similar today? Probably not. However, the Vuelta was beautifully poised, wasn't it, going into today's stage after a thrilling few stages at the end of last week. We left the Vuelta on Sunday night with Adam Yates having just won what I suppose most people were referring to as the Queen Stage to Granada, and we left the Vuelta with Ben O'Connor in the red jersey leading the Vuelta a España. His advantage had been cut to 3 minutes 53 seconds from Primoz Roglic, but Richard Carapaz had moved up to third. He was 4 minutes 32 down. Enric Mas was 4 minutes 35 down. So Richard, both of those riders, Adam Yates and Ben O'Connor, were in my crosshairs this morning. I wanted to speak to Adam Yates about the journey up here when he was presumably savouring what he'd achieved a few hours earlier. And I wanted to speak to Ben O'Connor about, among other things, I say I wanted to speak to him, this just sort of came up in conversation, his portrayal in infamous, I'm going to use that again, the infamous Netflix series in which he sort of unwittingly became one of the stars of the show. So here's Adam Yates and Ben O'Connor this morning.
Obviously, during the stage, I was just thinking about the stage win, not the GC, but when you look at it now, I'm not close, but I'm closer than I was. So I think we'll see. I was suffering with the heat the last 9 days, and hopefully the weather stays cool and I find some legs. If not, maybe I lose some time and try again for a stage, but we'll see today and we'll find out.
Adam, how was the plane journey the other day? A bit surreal, I would guess, after the day you'd had.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, but it's okay. I mean, it's better than doing 1,000 km in a bus. So it was, late arrival, but in the end, we had the best day, so it was all good.
Did you have internet so you could kind of, I don't know, glory in everything that people were saying about your stage win?
No, I didn't say anything. I mean, it was kind of rushed. Obviously, I had to do all the presentation, all the stuff after the race, and then, on the bus straight over to the airport, and that was it, you know. So I didn't even get to call my wife until the day after, really. So, but that's how it is, you know. It's professional bike riding, and that's how it is.
And did you sleep? Because I guess after a day like that, you're just full of adrenaline. I guess you got images of the day going through your head.
Not really. I mean, luckily we could lie in a little bit, but during the night I was still wide awake. And that's how it is, you know. You put a big effort like that, and it's hard to sleep. It's hard to recover. And so luckily we had the rest day.
Why are you a bike rider, and what made you fall in love with the bike?
I think just because I'm good at it, to be honest. I like to be outdoors nonetheless, and I love sport no matter really what it is. I kind of gave it a crack because it was a sport that I liked to watch when it was on TV back in Australia, and I had a really good friend who kind of coaxed me into it, and it kind of came from there.
Was this also always your dream to wear the leader jersey?
Yeah, I guess one of them. It never started like that, but as you get closer to that potential and knowing, you know, what can you do? What's actually possible? I've gone through periods where I didn't really have too many contract options, and I thought about going back home. And then now you're in this situation where you're leading a huge race, you know, on stages of Evergrande Tour now. So it's funny how things can change. You just have to, you know, keep tackling them and believe in yourself.
And if people haven't talked to you but only seen the Netflix series, do you think they have the right impression of you?
If you watch the Netflix series, no. But I guess that's what TV is. It's there for entertainment and drama, and it doesn't always show you and how you should be and how you actually are. At the moment, I'm a happy man. I'm relaxed. I'm enjoying it. For sure, I'm an angry man sometimes. I'd hope I'm not a bad person, and yeah.
I don't want to traumatize you, but how uncomfortable was watching that on Netflix? And well, just describe the experience of watching yourself.
I think some moments are pretty true. Others, there's just like zero context to the shot. And you know, the shot's not related at all to the event in play. So it can be a little frustrating, but whatever. You have to try and just forget about it. And really, who cares what someone in America or another person in Australia thinks of you? You know, I believe in myself and I go about my business how I choose it.
You just watch it at home and know what was coming.
Well, the thing is, you don't really know what's coming because you don't have any preview. You have a hint from the team saying that's how it's going to happen, but I don't know what part of the questions they get you. And remember, you sit in front of this camera for 2 hours answering questions. Things sometimes just get a bit out of hand and they just take context from there, even though it's not related.
So, Richard, what did you make of that from Ben O'Connor particularly?
It's interesting, isn't it? It's not the first time I've heard a rider express those sorts of views about the Netflix documentary. Perhaps the way that it portrays or exacerbates, accentuates, maybe twists the way that their character is portrayed. And certainly when it comes to taking bits of interview sort of out of context or mishmashing them around in order to give a certain narrative or spin a certain line. And I think it's something that the F1 teams have also noticed and raised a few eyebrows about, where with Drive to Survive, which was the sort of the original series, wasn't it, from which Unchained was supposed to kind of not a spin-off, but you know, take sort of riff on and emulate. Well, we never really ended up discussing it all that much just before the Tour de France. There was an undercurrent of discussion about it at the Tour this year, and the film crews were there again. You know, sort of, there's something slightly unusual about the way that it's filmed in that the producers and the cameramen are all sort of embedded within the teams, aren't they? I mean, you must have noticed this as well, Daniel.
Yeah, until they get kicked out, which might happen at some point in the future if they carry on portraying people in this manner, because, yeah, journalistically, from the point of view of journalistic integrity, some of the ways in which they sort of cut their cloth were a little bit questionable, I would suggest. Mm.
I mean, it's sort of a Faustian pact that cycling has made or is contemplating making, isn't it, with the promise of wider exposure and more money, I guess, that comes from having a hit show on Netflix. I haven't come across the numbers. I'm not sure Netflix have ever really made them public, do they, how many times a show is viewed, or you know, what the viewing figures are, and therefore whether it's been a success for them or not. Have you come across that at all? No,
they were fairly encouraging at first. I know sort of the release figures the first week, they were pretty good, but I don't know how good a gauge that is of the sort of longevity of the show. Of course, nothing, Richard, but full journalistic integrity in the cycling podcast.
Absolutely.
and particularly the tale of the Etapa. 60% accuracy, but 100% integrity.
El resumen de la Etapa. The tale of the Etapa.
Richard, stage 10 of the Vuelta a España, from Ponte Arias to Bayona, 160 kilometres, 3,243 metres of altitude gain. Ponte Arias, birthplace of three Vuelta winners, the most fecund city, fertile city, surely in Europe in terms of producing Grand Tour winners. Delio Rodríguez won in 1945. His brother Emilio won in 1950. Their brother Manuel was second in 1950. And Álvaro Pino won in 1986.
Just before my time, Daniel, most of those. I was worried you were going to ask me to name them.
Yeah, and I'm definitely not going to ask you to name the fourth Rodríguez brother, the fourth member of the dynasty, and there was a fourth, Pastor, his name was.
Pastor.
The day's route featured a second category climb, third category climb, second cat, and then the final first cat, the Alto de Mugas, which we've already talked about. Attacks, lots of attacks from the gun, Soler, Van Aert, King Stefan Kung, they were among the assailants very early on. But three riders eventually managed to detach themselves. Soler, William Jr. Le Cerf of Soudal Quickstep, And Van Aert himself, they went over the first climb of the day a few seconds ahead of the peloton. The pace was pretty rapid at this point, 38 kilometers an hour up to the top of that first climb. Yuri Holman of Alpecin De Koenig and Quentin Paché of Groupama eventually joined that trio on the descent of that first climb. A couple of riders tried to bridge across. Mike Woods of Israel Premier Tech was one of them. Alessandro De Marchi also tried to do the same. De Marchi actually got to 1 minute and 30 seconds from the five-man lead group with 77 kilometers to go. But then he sat up. At that point, the peloton was at 3 minutes 34 from the leading five, and they'd sort of decided en masse. You could see there was a consensus that they were going to let them go. With 70 kilometers to go, the gap was up to 440, so they were definitely going to contest the victory at that point. Decathlon, of course, Ben O'Connor's team, they were pulling mainly in the peloton. The gap was up to 6 minutes at the base at the start of the final three climbs. We got news of an abandonment around about that point. Giulio Ciccone, who had a pretty anonymous water up until that point, little trek, he abandoned the race. There was also a crash, 39 kilometers to go. Sylvain Moniquet, former holder, wearer of the Mountains jersey here, he crashed with Simone Petilli of Intermarché Wanty. With 31 kilometers to go, so we're now before, we're just coming up to the Alto de Mugas. Wout van Aert accelerates into an intermediate sprint, takes the points, and he carries on going. Quentin Paché latches, well, he accelerates behind Van Aert and latches onto his front wheel. So now we get two riders at the front of the peloton. Not too much going on in the general classification group. We saw Dani Martinez come to the front. We wondered whether Red Bull Bora would up the pace again, but they didn't really. EF Education Easy Post sort of did accelerate with Cepeda, but there was no attack from Carapaz. That was probably just a sort of controlling move, I suppose. There were some prominent names getting dropped. David Gaudu was getting dropped. Mike Woods, Kian Uterbrooks was having another difficult day, and he had been dropped as well. Over the Alto de Mugas, it became pretty clear that Le Cerf, Soler and Holman were not going to come back. So it was going to be a two-up, well, sprint, we imagined would probably be the case. Although Quentin Paché did try with 1.5 kilometres to go, around about 1.5 kilometres to go, as they descended into Bayona to untether himself from Van Aert. It was a pretty, well, it was a wholehearted attack, but it never really looked like succeeding. Van Aert was promptly back on his wheel, and there was no real contest in the sprint, was there, Richard? It was what they call a bit of a cakewalk. Behind, I'll give the stage standings, or I'll give the top 10 riders on the stage. Van Aert won the stage, Paché second, then Soler, Le Cerf and Holman actually came in well down in the end, 2 minutes, 1 second behind Van Aert. Then we had Chomin Juaristi of Westgaltel, who had attacked actually on the Alto de Mugas. He got away and a few seconds. And then Jonathan Narváez led home the main peloton ahead of King Stefan Kung. Richard, over to you to tell us whether there are any moves, significant moves on general classification.
None whatsoever, Daniel. Pretty much as you were in the top 20. It was a stage that threatened a little bit. There might have been a bit of GC action. There was, you know, the way that Red Bull, Bora, Hansgrohe were coalescing at the front of the peloton, the main group, what was left of it at that point. You know, on the Alto de Mugas. Well, Decathlon did quite a good job of keeping control of things, didn't they? There were always a couple of riders around Ben O'Connor. Did what they had to do today. Kept a lid on any GC action, didn't they? I'm not sure. Do you think that the riders perhaps have one eye on what's coming the rest of this week as well?
We shall discuss that. And, well, why it didn't turn into a GC day in part two, I propose. We'll give the standings in the other classifications first, Richard, before we hear from a couple of the protagonists in today's stage. Points jersey, Wout van Aert has extended his lead, well, significantly extended his lead, 243 points now ahead of Caden Groves, who's got 162. King of the Mountains, Adam Yates still leads, although Wout van Aert, I think he's still got the jersey, although Wout van Aert has drawn even on points. He's also on 22. And Florian Lipovic still leads the young riders classification. He's still in the white jersey. Let's hear now, as promised, from some of the main players today. Let's hear from stage winner Wout van Aert, Quentin Pacher, the runner-up, the plucky runner-up. And let's also hear from Wout van Aert's director sportif of Visma Lisa Bike, Mark Rafe.
First of all, with the five guys in the front, it's only five, but on the other hand, it's still four guys who look at you that you are the favorite, I guess, especially in the sprint finish. So yeah, then it's always better to attack instead of defending, and that's what I did. And I have to say, once I was with Quentin in the front, we really worked well together, and I felt confident, of course, coming to the sprint, but on the other hand, yeah, it seemed like he also felt confident because we were quite good together and he didn't hesitate. So, yeah, I never underestimated him. And, yeah, only with 1.5K to go or something when he tried to attack me, then I knew, like, maybe he doubts a bit about his sprint. And it also brought me in the perfect position coming from his wheel. So, yeah, at that moment, I really thought, like, okay, this one, I have to finish it off. And that's what I did, but I have to say congrats to him because he was a really nice companion and he was really strong.
Yeah, it's a rider is really hard to beat because he can do everything. I just give my best to the end, and at the end I know if I finish with Wout at the sprint, I'm second, but it's not so bad. I finished second in a stage of La Vuelta 2 years ago. Now I really want a win on a GC stage. I try in Tour de France, I try now, and I have two more weeks to try it again.
Quentin, tell us about that moment in the intermediate sprint when Wout accelerated and, well, you just about held on.
At the start, I was thinking he only won the point. You know, nobody will do the point because nobody care about it in the breakaway. So I was thinking maybe he want to take a gap before the climb. It was a key point for me because if I lose his wheel, I will never come back for sure. So I do a really strong effort before the start of the climb. It was the first key point for me in the breakaway. I prefer to be here and be by Wout van Aert to be in the peloton. So yeah, I give my best and don't think too much, you know.
Well, Mark, we know that Wout and I guess the team had almost, well, he probably put pressure on himself at this Vuelta. He said to himself, I've got to come here and win a couple of stages. Was this always one of the ones that you were looking at?
No, not directly. Of course, we knew that when he would make it into a break, that that the chance is there that he can win it. But we highlighted more the stages that, where we had the belief that we could control the stage and that he could win from a sprint. We had already a few behind us, and he was all the time in the top three. And this was the first real chance that that he could win from the breakaway, and that's immediately finishing it off. That's it's incredible, and it also shows again what kind of rider he is.
When that group gets away, the five of them, what are you thinking in the team car? What are you telling him? Obviously, there are some strong guys there. Marc Soler is a really strong climber, and so on and so on. So, what were the key things that you were trying to tell him?
In the start, it was already a really, really long fight to be able to get the gap. First, they were with the three of them. Later on, two crossed the bridge across. Yeah, and then at one moment, then we also saw that that the bunch completely let it go. Asche de Zer took control, and we knew the parcours, what was coming. He just needed to eat and drink and do his part of the job together with all the rest, and especially on the climbs and on the steep parts that he needed to pay attention on the others, and especially what you say with Soler, he's not scared to attack from far, so we needed to be ready also that he should was going maybe on the second last climb already. And we also know that although the gap is already 41 points to Groves before the stage, that maybe they were thinking of that as well, and that that also in the part towards the intermediate sprint that he needed to be sharp on Holman, that also on the flat part in between the climbs that maybe attacks would come, and then at the intermediate sprint, the idea was there to go full for it and to see if there was a gap, and then to continue to already create a gap to the other strong climbers, and that he succeeded in together with Pacher. And he could bit by bit increase the gap, and together with Pache, they were the strongest, I think.
And it seems as though, well, he's on top form now. He's found his legs. You know, he wasn't thrilled when he came to the Vuelta with his condition, but it seems like he's where he wants to be now.
Yeah, it's still going with ups and downs. One day is better than the other, but I think that you can say, yeah, we can say that that the shape is at the moment pretty good. Yeah, and there are still days to come where he has a chance, but yeah, we have to be happy with where he is at this moment, and we are very happy with the three victories that we are having now already, and with the cap that we have in the green jersey competition.
And just on one of your other riders, we've seen Kian struggling for a few days. What's happening with Kian?
He's not feeling completely how he's used to feel. Still, we believe that there's something inside him that he still can do something in this Vuelta. Also, day by day, it's different. From day to day, the feeling is different. Yesterday, after the rest day, he was feeling quite okay again. Today, in the start, he did some attacks. He blew himself up, and then he had difficulties to follow the bunch. And of course, that is not something where we're used to. When we look to him and also what he performed last year, maybe with the days that need to come, that are coming, that he can follow the bunch in the first place, and then later on in the third week that there's still something possible. At this moment he's healthy, he's not sick, so we still look ahead to do something with him.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by MAP.
So Richard, that was our stage winner, Wout van Aert, Quentin Pache, and Mark Rafe, who always laughs when he sees me coming because I call him Dennis Bergkamp. He bears a very strong resemblance to the former Arsenal footballer Dennis Bergkamp.
Did he fly on the rest day, Mark Rafe? Dennis Bergkamp?
I think he did fly on the rest day. Well, if you don't, if you're a rider and you decide not to fly on the rest day, well, you can't decide. You're banned from doing that. All the riders have to travel using the same means of transport, don't they? Urs Zimmermann in the... Which tour was that? It was in the 86 tour, was it? Or 89 tour? Swiss rider. He also had the same fear of flying as Dennis Bergkamp, a former Arsenal and Netherlands footballer. And he took a train on a rest day from somewhere, I think it was in Brittany, from Brittany down to somewhere near Bordeaux. And they didn't, the Société du Tour de France, they threatened.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Chuck him out, and there was then some kind of protest from the other riders, and he was reinstated, if I'm remembering that correctly. Talking of transport, Richard, something that I forgot to mention in the intro. Bayona, this place where the stage finished today, is famous because this is the town where Europe en masse, or the first people in Europe, became aware that the New World had been discovered. The gentleman, Spanish gentleman, who sailed with Cristoforo Columbus, to the Americas at the end of the 15th century, he returned here to Bayona about 4 days before Columbus made it to where they'd sort of got lost. They'd lost each other at sea, and Columbus docked in Lisbon. So it was here in Bayona that people first heard the stories. Yes, poor old Quentin, who, if I'm not mistaken, has never won a race. Am I right?
As far as I can tell, that's the case.
Never won a pro race.
Well, never won a pro race. That's the second time he's been second in the Vuelta. Quentin was one of those riders who... Do you get this on races, Daniel, where you feel like you're seeing the same person all the time. Like you'll be waiting outside the buses and it's the same face that just kind of glides past you at the end of a stage, but you never really speak to them. Quite often it's a rider that you might not have ever interviewed before and you kind of have to look up, like, oh, what? Who is this person? And for me on the tour last year, this year, that was Quentin Pache. He was just always there, kind of following me around, and I never did interview him. I wish I kind of had done, really. But yeah, he kind of gave that sort of obligatory, gave it a go, didn't he, with a kilometer to go, more or less. But
yes,
it was sort of like Wout van Aert was kind of like a cat toying with a mouse, really. I mean, there was never any doubt, was there?
He was a dead man walking, unfortunately, for a long time, Quentin Pache, as soon as he went away. I mean, for such a high quality rider, and he really is, he's a guy who, even in, you know, there were stages of the Tour de France where I can't remember, there was one day where he sort of lined out the whole peloton, you know, a peloton of the best riders in the world, and he's a guy with that kind of power when he's in form.
Yep.
So for him not to have won a pro race, and he is 32 years old, is quite remarkable, and I feel quite sad for him, actually.
I do too. And he was in the top 20 on the final TT of the tour. And I'm pretty sure he was up there on that Bologna stage as well. You know, the one that Kevin Vauquelin won. I don't quite mean too good, but he's almost too versatile, if that makes sense, where he can climb, he can time trial, he can mix it up in a classic or, you know, on a three-week stage race. But you've seen riders who are less versatile but more specialist win much more than riders like Quentin Pache, which is kind of sad, isn't it? But also, I quite like that about cycling as well, that you kind of get these people that you want to root for. They feel sort of, the deck's always stacked against them.
Richard, you used the word versatile there. There are a few riders more versatile than Wout van Aert, and he seems to have found his groove, doesn't he? He seems to have found his legs, and my fear, well, not fear, you know, I'm an admirer of Wout van Aert, but my fear for the rest of the peloton, I suppose, my feeling is that he might become quite a dominant figure in this Vuelta a España. I said a couple of days ago that I thought two stage wins was par for him, and there was a lot of expectation, a lot of hype about how many stages he was going to win here. He's got the green jersey pretty much sewn up, three stages now, and I think he will feel unburdened. And we've seen before the in-form rider, sort of breakaway specialist at the Vuelta a España, they have in the past sort of reeled off two, three stage wins, or certainly two anyway. That's happened several times over the last few years, and I feel that might happen with Van Aert. Well, from three he might well get to four or five.
Do you think that's now the primary focus for Visma Lisebike? Because, you know, I was looking at where Sepp Kuss is on the GC, over 8 minutes down, and he was playing that kind of pseudo lead out man role, wasn't he, for Wout on stage seven, was it? When Kuss was pulling, and it was Soler, in fact, I think, he was away on that kind of motorway section. Is Kuss ruling out a GC ride now, or is it, what's the sort of situation at that team?
I tell you what, we'll park that thought and we'll hear from Sepp about something else. And I spoke to Sepp at the finish about why today didn't turn into more of a general classification shootout, shall we say. And then we'll discuss his GC ambitions after that.
Seb, was that the story all day? Well, maybe the wind or meant that it wasn't a GC day ultimately, or did you always know even this morning that it probably wasn't going to turn into one?
It definitely could have. Yeah, we did an almost identical final in 2021. So for sure, if a team took it up from the third to last climb, then there would be probably some gaps. But until halfway up the last climb, it was pretty controlled pace, so hard to say.
How many guys have you spoken to, and well, today particularly in the peloton, I guess you didn't have much time to speak, have conversations, but how many guys have told you they're just really tired after 9 days?
Yeah, a lot. All, including myself. After 9 days in that heat, yeah, even when you have an easier stage, it still takes a toll on your body just being in those conditions. So everybody had a bit fresher legs, but I don't think anybody felt completely rejuvenated.
So Richard, first, Sepp there talking about the wind today. You know, I mentioned the sort of sea breeze, the Atlantic breeze. I guess that did have a bit of an effect today. I didn't think, I didn't sort of detect that was the main reason why we didn't get more action in the GC group. My feeling is that everyone's very tired. Well, I talked to Sepp there about how tired everyone was. He agreed. I think people are slightly intimidated by the amount of climbing that's still to come. And I also think we've reached that point, sort of the opposite of a sweet spot, the kind of sour spot in a Grand Tour, where a lot of riders in the general classification after the reshuffle over the weekend, particularly on Sunday, are broadly happy with where they are and they don't feel as though they need to do anything drastic. That's my feeling.
Something which Ben O'Connor said at the end of the stage, the job that Decathlon Agidazer had to kind of do today was to marshal the riders who were sort of 5th to 10th in the GC and stop them from gaining a place or gaining time by shuffling up into that breakaway, sort of stealthily sneaking up there and leapfrogging a few others. So I don't know, I'm not entirely sure I agree with that, but I do wonder whether it's difficult for any of the GC teams and GC riders to definitively make and strike out for a strong move to try and gain a position or a certain amount of time based on how strong they are. Looking through the start list, I don't really see a particularly strong team. Visma Lisa Bike and UAE Team Emirates accepted, but as we've sort of mentioned with Sepp Kuss, he's down in 14th. Well, Adam Yates, the best of UAE, he's at 5:30, but you know, he was previously out of it, wasn't he? So I wonder what's, you know, how it's going to play out. It's quite exciting. It's a really good situation to be in, and a total contrast to what we saw in the Giro and the Tour.
I mean, to answer your question, or just to give my view on what you said about Sepp's general classification at the moment, I mean, he's 14th, 8 minutes, 16 down, and he's had a strange race, actually, so far. I don't think the course up to this point has particularly suited him, and when you talk to him, he doesn't seem to be alarmed by his form or lack of form. I think he's broadly happy with how he's felt. I don't really see him making the big moves that some other riders might make. It's almost ironic that last year, one of the reasons he was able to get as much time as he did was that he wasn't really considered that dangerous by a lot of his rivals. Currently, he's probably still considered too dangerous, even though he's 8 minutes 16 seconds down, to be led off the lead. And yet, I think probably what he's shown so far suggests he's actually not that dangerous. I don't see him posing the same threat to O'Connor as some of the other guys, even around. I mean, I think anything under 10 minutes, I think even George Bennett, we've been speaking to him a lot and he's been entertaining people with his, shall we say, forthright and very candid interviews on a variety of topics. But he is 16th on general classification, 9 minutes 50, so just sort of under that 10 minutes threshold. And he talked to us the other day about this kind of game of snakes and ladders that he sees himself as being very much a sort of a potential participant in, and I would sort of agree with that. But my concern for this race, as I said earlier, people feel they've got enough time and there are enough opportunities to not take a big swing until maybe the Ancares on Friday. So, you know, tomorrow's stage I don't think will be that eventful, and the day after I don't think will be that eventful either. Certainly as far as general classification is concerned, I think we'll see a big fight for a breakaway tomorrow again, and I think Wout van Aert could have a go again, and I think it'll be dangerous again. Another rider, incidentally, who I see in a sort of similar vein to Wout van Aert but without the very conspicuous success at the moment, is Stefan Kung. He's riding brilliantly at this Vuelta. He's on fantastic form. I spoke to him this morning, actually, just about why he's riding so well. He's done a similar program to Van Aert and had a similar sort of season. Had some bad luck, some illness, didn't feel great necessarily throughout the Tour de France. Went to the Olympics and has come out of the Olympics, he said, just feeling fantastic. We saw him sprinting in the peloton today, and Narváez pipped him in that group sprint. But I see him as being very dangerous tomorrow as well.
If Stefan Kung is going to be in the breakaway, then logically Wout van Aert is going to be there as well. Do you think Kung is going to beat van Aert at this Vuelta? I'm not sure I see it. As much as I like Stefan and I'd like him to succeed.
I mean, I don't think anyone's going to beat Van Aert in a sprint, are they? So, you know, that's the great difficulty. And based on today, it's going to be very difficult to drop Wout Van Aert on a climb as well. Certainly anything under sort of a 10% climb.
I mean, it's exactly what we were saying about Quentin Paché, wasn't it? Incredibly versatile rider just coming up against...
Exactly.
A better one.
Richard, I talked about people being aggressive or not being aggressive over the next few days. Certainly, we expect Richard Carapaz to continue to be aggressive in the same way that he was on Sunday. That's just his style of riding, isn't it? He always looks aggressive on a bike, even when he's not making a particularly aggressive move. But we do expect him... to not be satisfied ultimately with his third place currently, and 4 minutes 32 seconds down on Ben O'Connor. Richard, I thought as the subject of today's Encuentro del Día, it would be interesting to catch up with one of Carapaz's teammates, James Shaw, who, as we mentioned earlier in this Vuelta a España, sort of turned up in Lisbon with his one arm sort of hanging off. He'd crashed in the Vuelta a Burgos and he'd posted an x-ray on social media which showed his shoulder in, well, it looked to me as though it was in several parts. It was in pretty bad shape. I thought I'd grab a word with James this morning to get the inside line on what EF Education First are planning and how he's feeling in this Vuelta a España. So it's time for today's
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
Well, James, a really good day for you guys on Sunday. I mean, Juanma said to me that had been planned 3 or 4 days earlier. I don't know whether he's sort of bigging himself up there, but you can confirm.
That was always the plan from Lisbon, and then we might have lost a little bit of faith in between, but we're taking it day by day, and there's no plan B, so we're going with that.
When you say that was the plan from Lisbon, you mean for Richard to lose time and then to sort of boomerang back?
Well, I think the losing time part was probably not. I mean, ideally, I think we wanted to stay on time, but obviously, yeah, that was the plan. So that was not the plan, but that's what happened. So that's what happened, and we stuck to plan A, and he executed it well. And yeah, we'll see what happens from now on.
How does it change your role? Because I guess when you came here, maybe you were thinking you'd have a bit more freedom. I don't know.
Came here for Richard. That was made very clear before the race. And I was told that if I didn't want to come and ride for him, to stay home. And so now I made the decision to come and ride for Richard. And like I said, there's no plan B at the minute. It's all in for Richie. So
I remember you saying that actually in Lisbon. Also in Lisbon, I asked you about your shoulder, which was in pieces after Burgos. How is it now?
It's still a bit sore. It's a lot better. I got a heat stroke the other day, which was the worst thing actually. I'm still recovering from that, but like I say, day by day, and I'm slowly getting better. So.
Well, just tell us about the heat stroke. Where did it happen? And give us the graphic detail if you can.
It's just like after the stage, just felt like I had flu.
Which day, James?
Saturday's stage. After Saturday's day, I got on the bus and I was like, whoa, fuck, I feel really sick. Yeah, and it was just a bit of heat stroke, so it was lying in cold baths for 15 minutes before and after dinner, this kind of stuff, and it was a bit bizarre. I've never had it before, but it was quite scary.
No, you're not the only one. And just looking forward to, well, this week, Richard's obviously an aggressive rider. Broadly speaking, is it an aggressive plan for the week? I guess you've had a sort of briefing yesterday about the whole week. I mean, is it a broadly aggressive plan for the team?
I think it's obvious it's aggressive. You know, I think there will be days when we're less aggressive, and there will be days when we're more aggressive. I think this style suits Richie well. You know, it's punchy, and he's traded a bit of his punch for a bit of diesel, as we saw on Sunday. So I think he's got more of a rounded rider now and planned around that. And I think this Vuelta suits him better than other Vueltas and other Grand Tours as well, so should be good.
And that haircut's really settled down now as well.
Yeah, and the moustache. I think if he goes into red, then maybe we all have to do the moustache thing.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
So, Richard, Carapaz has no intention of laying down arms. That was one of the messages, certainly, from my Encuentro del Día with James Shaw there. Carapaz's haircut looking very dapper, police report. The moustache less so, certainly in James's opinion. Carapaz, 4 minutes 32 behind. Where does he stand in your kind of ranking of palpable, likely, plausible winners of this Vuelta a España?
Highly plausible, I think. I was about to say I was super impressed, and I realised I don't really like... It's one of my little bugbears about cycling, is the way that super is used a lot too much, in my opinion. I was super impressed, nevertheless, with Carapaz.
Oh, come on the day, when we are paying tribute, is probably the wrong word, but on the day when we're remembering Superman, yeah, I think it's allowed.
Okay. He was superb in the Tour, especially in the third week. I really don't have any doubts about him in terms of like whether he will be able to be consistent as a GC contender over 3 weeks. I have some questions for you though, Daniel, because I wonder to what extent you think Primoz Roglic is going to be up there and competitive for 3 weeks, both in the sense of how strong Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe are. I have my doubts watching on from my vantage point, and also how he is, you know, his recovery from this back injury, which you see tweets and murmurings and mentions and news stories here and there, just trying to gauge the temperature as best I can from here. It sounds like that's not gone away and might come back to become a hindrance to him.
Primoz's own, God love him, Primoz's own declarations themselves, his own statements are always so comically almost opaque that you can't really glean anything from them. And well, we heard earlier in the Vuelta what George Bennett thinks of anything that Primoz says that might affect how his rivals think about, you know, his form, and basically you can't believe a word the guy says on that front. The best gauge is how he looks. I don't know how much the back has got to do with it. Primoz Roglic we saw on Sunday reminded me of the Primoz Roglic we saw in the final stage of the Dauphiné. You know, I do have questions about whether there is a slight, I'm not even sure it's a decline, but certainly, you know, we know that the peloton and the riders that Primoz Roglic is up against, and that's a sort of revolving door. It's a different cast of characters every year, but that sort of line on the graph is going up. He's either flatlining, you would think, although I have heard murmurings this year that his numbers are better than ever, but I don't think his numbers have improved at the same rate as the guys he's up against. I do worry slightly for him. I think the two categories of mountain stages to come, or there are punchy stages to come, there's one type of mountain stage and then there's another type of mountain stage. I said this to Fran the other day, and I think the Coto Negro stage and then maybe the Picon Blanco stage are the worries. I expect Roglic to be really good on the other mountain stages and the punchy stages like tomorrow. For what's going on in the team and how harmonious the team is, how in control they are, how happy they are, that's a difficult question to answer as well, because we've seen, sometimes you just get a feeling around the team and you watch the way the riders are interacting after finish lines, and I think there have been some misunderstandings, miscommunications, or maybe it's just still a bit of a sort of acclimatization process for Roglic, because every time he's been at a race this year, well, until this one, he talked about having to find his bearings within a new environment. We know he was at Jumbo-Visma Lisa bike for so long. That was the only really top-level team he'd ever been in. So he'd really sort of emphasized that in interviews throughout this year. Here he hasn't. However, he has not spent a lot of time with this particular group of riders. and it's a little bit of a, I don't want to say a motley assortment of riders, but you know, there are lots of different nationalities there, different languages, different experiences, different probably hopes for this Vuelta, and different hopes for their own individual careers as well. And I just see it as a sort of complicated set of ingredients that they're trying to fit together, blend together here at this Vuelta. But again, you know, that's an armchair observation. I'm closer than people watching on their television screen, but I'm certainly not within the inner sanctum. I do worry for him slightly. I mean, he looked great in those first two sort of punchy finishes, and the one to Villegas and then the one to Cazorla. He looked fantastic. He looked like vintage Roglic, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I wonder whether today, you know, really vintage Roglic would have done something on today's stage, especially with that little uncategorized kicker towards the end. Just tested the waters. Just, it felt like perhaps it's just the general mood of the bunch on today in particular, the sort of ceasefire. Perhaps I hope for a little bit more from him today in particular. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think one feature of the Jumbo-Visma teams that he was on was that he was always surrounded by more senior, more experienced riders. And, you know, when I say experienced, we think of Roglic as someone who's been around for a long time. But you do still hear, and you know, we all joke about the fact that you're a former ski jumper, new to the sport, and so on and so on. I know from speaking to other riders that over the years, he sort of made no secret of his naivety, and he's someone who asks a lot of questions. There was a story I think I told on the podcast a while ago. You know, I once asked Mark Cavendish whether he liked Roglic as a person. And Cavendish said that he was really impressed that, this wasn't that long ago, it was only a year or two ago, that Roglic, there was a situation, I think it was in UAE Tour, one of the golf races, when there was a group down the road and Roglic didn't understand why that group had gone down the road, and he rode alongside Cavendish and he said, what are they doing? And Cavendish sort of gave him an answer, and Roglic replied, yeah, there are a lot of things in cycling I still don't really understand, which sounds bizarre for a guy who's, you know, been winning Grand Tours for several years now. All of that to say that I think at Jumbo-Visma he was always surrounded by elder statesmen. On that Bora, or on that Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe bus in this Vuelta particularly, he's very, very much the elder statesman. Now, he's very much having to dictate the shape of things, is my sense.
And the team is looking to him, aren't they, as well? I get that feeling that he's their marquee big name signing, the first of that in a process that is going to be ongoing for the next few years as Red Bull really do what they want to do with that team.
Yeah, and I think a key part of the process this year with Roglic has been picking his brains. And I think they've done that since the training camps at the end of last year. They've wanted to absorb as much information as possible from him about how Jumbo-Visma were working, Visma Lisabike were working. That's a very different paradigm for him, as I say. Yeah, whether that's affecting the way he's riding, whether it will affect the way he's riding, he will ride in this Vuelta a España, we will have to see. But Richard, I propose we talk now briefly about tomorrow's stage.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
So Richard, Portuguese food last night again. I had goat last night, which was very good. I missed out on the goat, the first time in Portugal, but we were much further south.
Is goat a Portuguese specialty then?
Specialty, it is in certain regions.
What happens to the goat?
What do you mean, what happens to the goat?
How is it prepared?
I mean, it's not eaten a lot. Oh, okay. last night was roasted in rosemary. Kind of slow roasted, and it was very tender. It sort of fell off the bone. Very good, actually. It was quite delicious. And it was served with rice, which was interesting, unusual. You get that quite a lot in Portugal, rice as a side dish. And it was quite delicious. And we had a lovely Alentejo red wine, lots of big, beefy, generally very good value for money. Portugal is a very kind of cheap country to eat out in, certainly compared to some of its European neighbours. So that was very enjoyable. And a last little nod to Portugal, Vuelta a España, of course, that started here. It struck me the other day that, well, three Portuguese riders started this Vuelta, and we were down to one. Nelson Oliveira of Movistar pretty quickly. You can hear the bagpipes, I hope, in the background. Some typical Galician folk music. Lots of Celtic influences here, of course, playing in the background.
Once when I was cycle touring up in the very far northwest of Scotland, and I walked into a bar in a little fishing port, and it was just full of Spanish fishermen drinking Coke and red wine. And I'm presuming they might have come from Vigo or somewhere around, you know, Vigo just up the road from you is a big fishing, like a big port,
yes,
isn't it?
We're staying there tonight. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
No goats, hopefully.
No goats. Tonight. Hopefully there'll be some. There might be some Rías Baixas white wine and famous Albariño white wine. This region, these the four sort of inlets into the Atlantic coastline up here that are known as Rías Baixas. Very famous for its white wine up here. But Richard, we should talk about tomorrow's stage. It is a classics type profile and it's a circular route, and we are starting at an aluminium factory, the Campus Tecnológico Cortizo. Yes, Cortizo are a big sponsor.
I'm expecting a load of aluminium related factoids tomorrow night. They've done the Carrefour and now they're doing the aluminium. Yeah,
what's next?
What's next? What's new front? The next frontier of stage town starts.
Yeah. We're not starting in the aluminium factory, I don't believe. We're not starting, like, the riders aren't starting indoors. They started in the Carrefour, of course. It's a classics type profile, Richard. We're close to just outside Padrón, which is very famous for its peppers, for its green peppers, which a lot of people listening will have tasted at some point. Often served sort of as a starter. Very delicious they are as well. There was some at the press buffet today. But as far as the climbs are concerned, we've got third cat, second cat, second cat, third cat. The final climb on the route, the third cat, with 8 kilometres to go to the finish. It's a tough one, and it could be an interesting launch pad. I say it's a tough one, 2.9 kilometres. Puerto Cruceras, 2.0 kilometres, average gradient 9%. It will be interesting to see. We talked earlier about lack of GC action today. It'd be interesting to see, with that climb so close to the finish, whether someone might use it as a launch pad tomorrow. I'm thinking about Primoz Roglic. And 9%, I don't have the actual breakdown. I'm presuming there are some ramps that are steeper than 9%, because that's the average gradient. So, you know, if there is a sort of 12, 13, 14% ramp, who knows? We might see someone catapult out of the GC group and make things very interesting for us. Otherwise, I'm expecting a breakaway. What about you, Richard?
I reckon a breakaway as well. That little climb looks like one of those little goat tracks that the Vuelta just keeps finding. I expect kind of narrow roads, the sort of thing where perhaps a move, if we are expecting one in the GC group, if it goes, it might almost sort of be by accident, you know, where a rider who's 20 positions back might find themselves 400 metres behind the leader. Just by virtue of that, that might start to break things up. It looks like another Wout van Aert stage, doesn't it? We've said this before, but why not? Based on today's evidence, I'm not really sure who else I can see. What do you think UAE are up to? Pretty active again. Perhaps his success or lack of it in the breakaway today, you know, maybe a result of how active he has been in the race. But do you reckon they might try something tomorrow, either getting a rider in the breakaway or trying to bump Adam Yates? Or Sivakov is the next one on the GC for them, isn't he? 7 and a bit minutes down.
Yeah.
I think they might try something.
I think not. Mark Soler is doing Mark Soler things, which defy all explanation, logic, yes, and attempt to understand them. So who knows what he will do tomorrow, but I don't really see tomorrow is suiting Yates. Maybe McNulty might be let off the leash tomorrow. Or they could be trying to conserve people for later in the week when things get much more mountainous. Richard, I think we should probably leave it there. I'm just looking at my notes, whether there's anything I missed. Oh, I keep forgetting to say that in some of the interviews you're hearing, you'll also be hearing the voices of some of my colleagues, Laura Meseguer, of course, of Eurosport, and Søren Retz of TV2 in Denmark. I keep meaning to sort of credit them every day when we do hear those voices, but I keep forgetting, so apologies for that. Richard, until tomorrow.
Thanks, Daniel.
The The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.